The committee will come to order. Welcome everyone to the joint hearing of the House Elections Committee and the Senate Rules and Administration Committee Subcommittee on Elections. Thank you all for coming on what is a pretty cruddy day, but it's an important issue that we're here to discuss today, and I want to thank our Senate counterparts as well for this cooperative effort. Just by way of introduction, from my standpoint, we are here as the direct result of some reporting done by the Star Tribune and others about discrepancies in the numbers reported by the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board having to do with campaign receipts and those who wrote checks and those who received checks. And according to the article, which first ran in the Star Tribune on November 9th, there was a discrepancy alleged of up to $20 million over the course of a decade, a mismatch, so to speak, between what was reported as having been given and what was reported as having been received. And so after reaching out to the Campaign Finance Board, its leadership has agreed to appear here today and has been very cooperative, I must say, in all of this. And as I conceive of it, our purpose here today is this. It's not to scapegoat, and it's not to necessarily assign blame. But what we are here to do is to understand the dimension of the problem, as reported by the Star Tribune and others. We're here to understand how and why it happened. And most importantly, we're here to understand how we can make it better and how we can help the Campaign Finance Board make it better and what steps they will pledge to take to make it better. And I think ultimately what we're all after is not only accuracy, obviously, but we're really after transparency. It really is about transparency and making the work that the office does as complete and as accurate, but also as transparent to voters and citizens as possible. I think we all share the belief that citizens should know who's giving and who's getting, and the more we can improve the system, the more likely it is that they will have that information. So I think this is about a reform process and talking through where we've been, where we are, and where we're going. That is my conception of what we're here to talk about. So hopefully members will confine themselves to that subject. There are a lot of other election-related subjects that I'm sure people want to talk about. I can say that on the House side, we almost certainly will be having, in late January, a pre-session hearing where we can take up some of those other issues. But for today, we're here to talk about the Campaign Finance Board. So before we go on to testifiers, I wanted to open up to Chair Sieben for any opening remarks she had. And then if there are any other members who want to say anything here at the outset, at the beginning, then you're free to do that too. Senator Sieben? Well,
thank you, Chair Simon. It's a pleasure to see the committee together again, and I'd just like to first thank members of both bodies for putting together at the end of last session, I think, a pretty good set of policies that we can all here be proud of what we were able to accomplish last session. I'll echo much of what Chair Simon said and add to it by saying that in light of Citizens United, I think that and with increasing amounts of money coming into the political process, it's especially essential that we make sure that our campaign finance databases are transparent, accessible, searchable, not just to reporters, the good reporters from the Star Tribune who did a lot of legwork in digging up the story that we all saw, but to the general public so that those of us that we represent can see where donations that we received, that they're easily able to view them and take that into consideration when choosing who they're going to vote for or ultimately support to serve in public office. So I think I'll conclude with that. I'll thank the Campaign Finance Board for the work they've done thus far to prepare for this hearing. I think will probably hear this testimony, but I am particularly concerned or particularly interested in hearing about some of the additional monies that the Campaign Finance Board received in the last legislative session, how those dollars can be used to help address some of the concerns that we'll hear today at this hearing. Thank you. So with that, should we first, are there any members of the either committee who would like to make any comments? If not, we can go on to the opening comments or the presentation by Mr. Goldsmith, who's the executive director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Disclosure Board.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance Board. I want to thank the people in the crowd who are here to hear about this important question as well, including four of my board members who wanted to be here in person so that they could hear your comments as well as mine. And I will be briefing the board at its meeting tomorrow on this hearing and giving them even more detail than I'll have time to give you today. As the chair said, on November 9th, we had a headline in the Star Tribune, right on the front page, I'm told, although I don't get the paper copy. Minnesota Campaign Finance Regulators Database isn't adding up. And that was followed later by an editorial, an accuracy challenge in election spending. Some of the commentators were generous, including some of you who are on this committee or in this room. They were more judicious and recognized that there were questions and that it wasn't necessarily appropriate to judge the Campaign Finance Board as a whole or its staff based on a newspaper article. Others were less judicious, calling it, in one case, a slap at Minnesotans. I took that as an implication that we had either very carelessly or negligently allowed our data to become unreliable. I welcome this opportunity to talk with each of you, and I'm happy that it's in a hearing where we don't have a bill before us and we don't have to rush off to the next meeting, although I will keep my remarks confined so that there will be plenty of time for questions and the other testifiers. Although I had notice that the Star Tribune was going to report on this issue, I didn't have enough time to be able to explain to them or address what the issues were or what the problems were if they turned out to be problems, and so the article ran and it has the numbers in it that you're familiar with. My testimony today will be primarily about data and the process of getting data, transferring data, and using data. I want to clarify the issues that are raised by the report and identify what I believe are the real problems, because I do believe there are real problems. I will propose how we should address some of those issues, and the board will take further steps. My testimony this afternoon is taken in part from a report that I'm working on, a report to the Campaign Finance Board that I will present to the board tomorrow, but much of that report is being summarized in my testimony today. I will mention from time to time as I go through my testimony the question of resources, because there's been some suggestion that these problems or issues are tied more or less directly to resources, and I find that that's not particularly the case, although everything that a state agency does and every decision that an agency makes is in some way tied to its resources. In our case, our decisions are also tied in some ways to the resources of those that we regulate, namely volunteer treasurers primarily. I hope that as I go through this presentation or at the end through your questions and comments, I will get a sense of where you as the committees that regulate our policy would like us to go. The topic before us relates primarily to what we call reconciliation. The regulators' database doesn't add up, and by that I think the Star Tribune meant that they had found that in some cases, donors reported contributions that recipients didn't report, and it was impossible to match those two kinds of contributions. First of all, let me point out that the majority of contributions come from individuals, and of course individuals don't report to the Campaign Finance Board. So to the extent that individual contributions are reported in our database, they are from the reports filed with us, and we believe them to be generally accurate, with the possibility of a few data entry errors for those manual reports, those paper reports that we enter manually. We're really talking here about a second category of contributions, and that is the category where both the donor and the recipient report to the Campaign Finance Board. And of course that means candidate committees, party units, political committees, and funds. And in theory, where both the donor and the recipient report, you should be able to match up the donation and the receipt. And we in fact try to do that, and I will talk more about both the history and what we do now. When a contribution does match up with the donation and the receipt match up properly, that's said to reconcile, and when it doesn't, those are unreconciled transactions. Unreconciled transactions are pretty rampant, actually, when a set of reports comes in. This has nothing to do with the Campaign Finance Board, but rather with the treasurers who are filing the reports with us. An unreconciled transaction means that either the donor or the recipient has made a mistake on the report because they don't match up when they should. I brought along, just to illustrate, the sheets that come out of our computer system. This is just the 2012 year-end reports. There's around 40 or 50 lines on each page. And these are the data that has come out of our first step in our reconciliation process, which is a computer-generated step. And we have about 3,300 transactions in 2012 from the year-end reports that don't reconcile when they should. That means 3,300, or possibly half of that, mistakes made by treasurers, but 3,300 items that we have to reach out to treasurers to discuss. Now, the fact that these don't reconcile doesn't necessarily mean that there's any violation. It means that somebody made a mistake. And there are quite a few ways that treasurers make a mistake in spite of the electronic filing system that is designed to provide tools to help them not make those mistakes. A donor who mails a check to the correct recipient and address might nevertheless report it as going to a recipient with a similar name, and that won't reconcile. A union, on occasion, will transfer money from its union, from the union itself, to the registered political fund. Instead of reporting that as coming from the union itself, it will report the transaction as if it came from the political fund. In other words, a transfer from the political fund to the political fund, which cannot happen, and that won't reconcile. Sometimes committees or candidates pay rent, for example, to a local party unit for office space, and the candidate will report that as an expenditure for rent, which is correct, and the party unit will report it as a contribution, which is incorrect. Because we reconcile donations made against contributions received, that kind of a transaction won't reconcile, because we don't compare donations, don't compare expenditures to contributions received. Now, at this point, there is a resource issue that I said I would mention from time to time, and that is, why are people making so many mistakes? And the resource issue is on both sides. Number one, I would like to conduct more training. At the last legislative session, I told the legislature that I would conduct more training, and in fact, after the Star Tribune article came out, between then and now, I spent four and a half days actually traveling both to northern and southern Minnesota conducting outstate training sessions that had been scheduled before this issue came up, and we will continue to do that. We have rewritten all of our campaign finance handbooks for all of our entities, and we conduct training in the software, but it occurs to me as I look at this that while we're teaching people how to do things, how to enter something in the software, for example, we may not be effectively teaching them what they should be doing. In other words, how do you record this kind of transaction, or how do you recognize what this transaction is for reporting purposes? So there's a resource issue there for us, which I think we can address. without additional resources, and there's a resource issue for treasurers who will have to be willing to participate in some additional training. The whole question of reconciliation involves a fairly big policy issue, because as I pointed out, these reports come in and they go into the database, and we have more than 3,000 unreconciled transactions. What does an agency do at that point? In other words, the question is, what is the agency's responsibility for finding mistakes on reports, not violations, but just mistakes, and then making the parties correct those mistakes? We've always done a computer audit for violations, and we catch those and we deal with every single one of them. Various states have taken different positions on whether they ought to reconcile or require filers to reconcile. Wisconsin, for example, doesn't do anything. The reports come into their database electronically as they are, and that's how the data is published. And that data is accurate because it's represented as what the filer filed. And to the extent that our database represents what the filer filed, it's also accurate. A question for Wisconsin would be, do we then consider their database itself to be riddled with errors because the reports themselves are riddled with errors, or do we recognize that the Wisconsin database is an accurate representation of the information filed with us? That question will play through this discussion this afternoon. Other states do reconcile. I just came back from a national conference of regulatory agencies like ours, and I posed the question to many of my colleagues. As I say, some don't reconcile at all. Others do. Illinois probably has the strongest program I could find, and they manually review every report that comes in, but they have a staff of 14 auditors who do that. In most states, there's a cutoff. If you find a mismatched transaction that doesn't reconcile, if it's off by 10 cents, do you reach out to the treasurers to make them fix it, make them do an amendment? What's the threshold? It varies. In Minnesota, we actually did elect a $100 threshold. Prior to 1995, we did no reconciliation. Reports came in. There were no PDFs. We didn't scan. There was no database online. The reports were paper, and they were in the folders, and that was it. 1995 was my first year with the Campaign Finance Board, and I remember that an issue was raised, I believe by a newspaper, though I don't know which one, that a very big donation showed up on one report by a donor and didn't show up on the recipient's report. And it was at that point that the executive director at that time and I had a discussion, and we decided that we ought to implement some sort of reconciliation program, and we did so. We decided that there would be a $100 threshold, so if they matched within $100, we didn't reach out to the treasurers, and those were left unreconciled. We added computer routines that would identify mismatched contributions. The output is very similar to what we still do today. And then the process was that staff would go to the front tables in our office and start pulling reports, because there were no PDFs online, and manually determine whether things actually reconciled or not. That first year, there were 1,800 violations kicked out by the computer, or errors kicked out by the computer. After the staff looked through the physical reports, they determined that there were actually 798 true discrepancies. Part of the process at that time, and still, was to look at the report, and if it was the type of difference that a person looking at both reports physically could understand, we did not require the committees to reconcile. So if a union reported, a union political fund reported receiving a contribution from itself, we took no action. If a candidate reported rent and the party unit reported the receipt as a contribution, we took no action. At that time, I don't think that was looked at as a resource issue, other than possibly a resource issue for the candidates. The reports were only available in paper, and at that time, we weren't looking forward enough to see the point where, instead of paper, people might be looking at data in a computer database. And so of those 798 transactions, they involved 600 different committees. Outreach was done, and those were reconciled. But that leaves more than 1,000, and this is 1995, so we don't have the database. I don't know, we maybe do, but we don't publish it. That would have left more than 1,000 records in that database unreconciled, yet those records completely and accurately represented the file data. That's one of the points I will be trying to make, is that an unreconciled record in our database doesn't mean that the board has made an error or that the database doesn't represent what was reported by the committee. It maybe and probably means that the committee has made a mistake, and if the item remains unreconciled in our database, it means that for one reason or another, we have not either not taken action or not been successful in requiring a reconciliation. Another decision that was made at that time was to aggregate contributions over a calendar year. So all of the donations made by a donor to a particular recipient were added together. All of the recipients' receipts from that donor were added together so that when we reconciled, we only needed to reconcile one total number instead of trying to reconcile every individual receipt. They don't reconcile by date because donors make donations and then recipients get them later. So that decision was made. This is another resource issue because part of the reason that decision was made was that it allowed the data entry to be done more efficiently. Instead of entering 10 contributions from an individual, you could enter the total and have one data entry element. Again, this was done at a time when the data was strictly a tool for use in determining violations and reconciliation issues. It wasn't envisioned at that time that the data would be electronic. I think we weren't, in 1996 or 95, we weren't foresighted enough to recognize that we ought to be then taking steps to make sure that the integrity of the data was maintained to the quality that would be needed to make the data official. The one problem that is truly a problem that I recognize, and I think it's the significant problem, although certainly doesn't account for the dollar totals or counts that the Star Tribune came up with. In the process of reconciliation, often one party or the other is required to do an amendment because somebody has to fix the problem. And the policy of the board at the time and now was that those amendments, or any amendment filed, whether it's through reconciliation or otherwise, will be entered back into the board's database so the database stays consistent with the filed reports. Unreconciled transactions will remain unreconciled until the candidate or other treasurer fixes them. We have learned, partly through the Star Tribune's efforts and partly through our own, that not in every case were those amendments entered back into the database. And there are various reasons for that. I think this is one case where I would say resources was a serious contributing factor. Also, the lack of cooperation from treasurers in accomplishing our reconciliation was a very significant factor. We had one matter that we researched that a party unit who had many, many transactions to reconcile, did multiple amendments. The final amendment didn't come in until after the next year's reports were coming in, and for reasons unclear to me, that amendment did not get entered into our database, even though our policy was that it would. Toward the end of my talk, I will be telling you about a recommendation I will make to the board, that asking them to recommend to you some assistance in providing cooperation in this reconciliation process. In 1995, according to the Pew Research Center, only about 15% of U.S. households were using the Internet. By 2002, that was 60%. It was growing by leaps and bounds, and the pressure was on all state agencies to get data online. Public interest groups were doing research and publishing reports indicating and scoring states on their disclosure, and Minnesota routinely came up with a score of F for various reasons. And so, in 2002, in the board minutes in March, the executive director reports that online data is coming to the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board, and by June, the executive director is reporting that the data is available. And continuing improvements were reported through the minutes over the years subsequent to that, up through 2007, the year before I joined as executive director, at which time release of independent expenditure data was placed on the internet. The data actually is not, obviously not a model. Some others have presented what might be models for disclosure, and it's a goal that we certainly have. But there is significant data, and it is significantly searchable, and mostly it is accurate when you consider that it is intended to reflect what the filer reported. The times where it wouldn't be accurate would be if a staff member made a data entry error, which there are not very many of, or an amendment was not entered back into the system, and that I do not have a quantifying number for you at this time. But there were a couple of problems that I see that occurred from 2000 through 2007, and they really happened without anybody recognizing that they were happening. What the board was really doing, without recognizing it, was transforming from a paper record system to an electronic record system. Even though the board's databases that are published online are the unofficial records, they're really, we have to acknowledge, official, unofficial records. People rely on them, people use them, people do research on them. And I was unable in my research to find any significant discussion as this was being implemented beginning in 2002, recognizing that this was going to become an official electronic record. I have talked to this legislature, and I've talked many times to the board about a goal of converting to electronic records. And I've explained that the reason we haven't done that is because conversion to electronic records is a lot more than just putting data in a database or scanning files into PDFs. Policies and procedures have to be in place. The Historical Society has put out long books of guidelines as to what you need to do, and it needs to be managed as a real project with defined goals and processes in place. That didn't happen when the board began publishing electronic data. Really, the project was viewed primarily as a technology project. How do we take the data that's in our database and get it so people can look at it and search through it online? I could find, as I started to say, really no discussion or serious consideration about whether some evaluation of the quality of the data should be done. Now, again, I want to point out that had that evaluation been done, a couple of things would have occurred, but it probably wouldn't have changed the headline. One thing that would have occurred was the board would have recognized that there were many unreconciled transactions in the database, but that they were unreconciled because they remained unreconciled on filed reports. So the database the database represented accurately the filed reports. However, the board also would have reviewed the data accuracy of data that had been keyed in. And prior to 1998, that was all of the data, and really through subsequent years, it was a lot of the data until finally in 2012 when electronic filing became mandatory. Now the data entry is a minor part of the data that goes into the database. So they would have evaluated the accuracy of the data from a data entry standpoint. And finally, some review would have been done to determine the quality of the data with respect to keeping up with amendments that were filed to by committees. And those things weren't done, and that's a problem. It's a situation I'm not sure we'll be able to accurately quantify moving forward, but that's one of the tasks I have for myself, and I will be reporting to the board regularly on that. I am prepared now to tell you what I will be talking to the board about tomorrow, and what the board and I will be talking to you about as we move forward in the next legislative session. First of all, shortly after the board meeting and into the next month, we will be developing written policies and procedures to ensure that every amendment to a report is entered back into the database. One of the things I wanted to do when I came to the board, and here's another resource point, was to do a thorough evaluation of each of the board's programs, to actually sit down with program staff, go through what they do and why they do it and how they do it. I had a management analyst person who was going to do some of that, but the person in that position proved ineffective at being able to accomplish that task in the time that was available. So we are going to implement policies and procedures to make sure that the database tracks the amendment process accurately. There will be controls in place, including a second staff person who will review what's been done, also electronic tracking so that we can determine when an amendment comes in, when it gets into the database. I want to be able to report back to the board and to you on the frequency of amendments, the processing time it takes, and the progress that we've made to make sure that they're accurately entered into our system. I am going to ask the board to review the implications of the cutoff threshold for transactions below which we don't do any reconciliation. I have statistics that I won't bother you with, but I will bother the board with tomorrow and over the next weeks and months, analyzing the additional workload for the board, staff, and for treasurers if we lower that threshold to either $50 or $0 from the $100 that it is now. The workload will increase for both staff and treasurers if we do that, and probably in equal proportions. Our computer software can easily adjust the threshold and generate more unreconciled items. That's very simple. And our software also generates the letters that go out to the people who have unreconciled transactions. The work comes in the treasurers of both parts of the equation having to get together and figure out what happened, and one treasurer having to do an amendment. And the work on the staff side comes in with having to track these things and be sure that we understand when the amendment comes in and that gets into the database. This is a long, drawn-out process the way it works right now, and as I proceed, I'll explain to you how I hope we can make it a shorter process. We also have used a number of methods of handling transactions that require reconciliation. I mentioned to you one where it's obvious from the paper version of the report what the reporter, what the donor and the recipient intended. You can understand the transaction. However, that doesn't help now that we're primarily using a database, and so we can't rely on that anymore. We use a combination of change letters where we simply send a letter to the committee saying, we can understand this is what you did, we're changing your data in this way, and if you disagree, let us know. It saves the treasurer the job of filing an amendment if they agree, and typically those are used only for things where no one would disagree. We also use the process of ignoring the matter. I think we're going to have to abandon that process. And then we use the process of requiring amendments. So I'll be discussing with the board these various methods and determining what scope or what group of methods the board wants to use to handle reconciliation. For reports that will be coming in on January 31st of 2014, the calendar reports for this calendar year, I will implement a process by which the data that's manually entered by either contractors or board staff is fully audited by a second person to make sure that that data is accurate. I will also review whether we have the ability to go back and do that for 2012. That will depend on how many reports came in on paper. They're mostly small reports, so we may be able to do that audit for 2012 as well. Going back further, I'm not optimistic because electronic filing wasn't mandatory and there were lots of paper reports. We are also going to establish policies and procedures which will include more information on the board's website to explain what it is that the user is seeing. And at least for 2012 going forward, that is the current year's reports, we're reconciling 2012 right now. For 2012 that we're still working on going forward, there won't be very many unreconciled transactions, but we will have a clear disclaimer that will say if the donor and the recipient disagreed by less than $100, those are reported in the database as they were reported by the treasurers. That may not be where we end up. We may change that threshold. But whatever it is, the users of the data will understand exactly what the data is. We're also, and we've already actually begun this process, but we're also going to establish a process and consult with the board and get their input for addressing the most significant reconciliation items from previous years. These add up pretty quickly. We've already done reports of the top 50 reconciliation items from both the donor and the recipient standpoint for each of the last 10 years. The winner, I think, is the Democratic Central Committee for 2002 with unreconciled transactions from one particular donor of about $9 million. As you can understand, if we clear that, it's going to reduce the total unreconciled amount significantly. Now, to be fair to the Star Tribune, our totals are higher than theirs because we didn't exclude anything. If it didn't reconcile, we left it in as unreconciled, and they did some adjustments to eliminate some obvious errors. This particular error resulted because the treasurer of the committee reported a whole series of large contributions as coming from a DFL-related federal group that had terminated its registration when they should have reported them as coming from two or three different DFL groups who were unregistered with the board. So the money came in, the money was reported, the donors were not required to report to the board, and if it had been reported that way correctly on the recipient's report, there would have been no reconciliation item. But that's the kind of problem we're faced with, and I'm looking at those types of transactions, and we'll work with the board to determine to what extent we go through and reconcile old transactions that are very significant. I mentioned that I would be recommending to the board a statutory change, and I will be doing this when we meet tomorrow. Under current law, it's not a violation to make a mistake on a report. It happens all the time, 3,000 times in the last year-end report. It's only a violation if the treasurer fails or refuses to amend the report as requested. So when we do reconciliation, we're at somewhat of a disadvantage because we cannot compel an amendment because we don't know which side of the transaction was wrong. So all we can do is ask for them to look at it and come up with an answer for us from both sides of the equation. What I will be recommending to the board that they recommend to you is a statutory amendment that requires treasurers to cooperate with the board in its reconciliation process that will provide timelines similar to the timelines for amending a report, which is typically 10 days after you get notice, and will provide penalties for failing to cooperate, again, similar to failing to file. These things go on for more than a year. As I said, we're still in the 2012 reports, and this, again, is partly a resource issue. Many of you know, have worked with, or your treasurers have worked with our compliance officer. She's responsible for reconciliation, but she's also responsible for all of the violations in the campaign finance program, for advising the board on those issues, for filer support in filing, and a whole host of things. And that is one position where I actually think probably one person is coming close to doing the work of two people. I'm not recommending that my board suggest there should be a penalty for making a mistake. We need to work more proactively with treasurers to help them avoid mistakes. But I will say that the fact that there's no penalty for making a mistake eliminates really almost any incentive to try and do the work as accurately as you can. Many of these mistakes we can recognize are simply careless mistakes due to a lack of effort to try and recognize who a contributor is, for example. And that's frustrating to us. I will be talking to the board on a monthly basis, reporting to them on this issue and what we're doing about it, and seeking their input. And I look forward to continuing to work with the committees and the legislature and the legislature as a whole. And at this point, I would stand for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. I'm sure there are several members of the committee who want to say something. I'm going to start by first thanking you for your testimony, but then just saying a little bit, at least from my perspective, about the role of your agency. I really have to stress, I think that the Campaign Finance Board is more than a filing cabinet. It's more than a place where other people who are prone to mistakes file stuff. I think, if it isn't already clear, I think it should be, in my view, that the Campaign Finance Board really has to be a revealer of information. And I recognize that that takes some effort. It takes dollars. It takes resources. But I think particularly in this age, and you've described the kind of historical transformation, not only the age in terms of technology, but where we are, as Senator Sieben said, with respect to the oceans of cash involved now in campaign finance, it is really critical that the public understand what's going on. So while I understand that treasurers make mistakes, and sometimes they're dumb mistakes, I do think it's the job of the Campaign Finance Board to, as much as possible and as quickly as possible, find out when and where those mistakes are made and then quickly correct them. Because I think what's at stake is making sure that the public knows who's giving and who's getting. So being more than a filing cabinet is important. So I guess in terms of questions, I have a couple. The Star Tribune analysis said that at one point it was an error rate of about 1 in 7. And so while I understand that there are really big ones like the ones you talked about, millions of dollars from 2002, if the Star Tribune's reporting is correct, it was more than just the occasional kind of big whale donor. It was a consistent practice. So I guess my first question would be, do you agree that that's the scope of what the problem has been over a decade? And then the second question I have is, what percentage, roughly, of the problem that's been pointed out either by the Star Tribune or your own internal analysis includes situations where one or both treasurers were not cooperative, and what percentage, I guess, on the other side, would include cases where maybe they were cooperative, the problem was discovered, but maybe wasn't entered in a timely way on the website. I mean, I certainly understand if Group X claims to have given $500 to a candidate, and the candidate doesn't report it, and if you go to both treasurers and say, who's right, and no one gets back to you, of course, everyone would understand that, and I assume that's happened from time to time. But I'm wondering if you can isolate for us what percentage of the overall, first, the scope of the problem, and second, the percentage of the problem that is due to those kind of competing challenges.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. First of all, I agree that the board is certainly more than a repository. Our goal is to make the data available, but also to make it available in meaningful ways so that citizens can understand what it means. And I expect there'll be questions about our website, but that's going to be part of the goal of our revamped and completely redone website. To address your specific questions, our methodology and the methodology of the Star Tribune certainly differ because I don't exactly know what their methodology was, but I don't actually dispute their percentage very much. Our percentages were in that range, some slightly higher, some slightly lower, remembering, of course, that that includes all unreconciled transactions, which means, to me, an error by a treasurer, not necessarily an error in the data reflecting what the treasurer filed. So I understand what you're saying is it is our job to recognize these treasurer errors and get them fixed. And so there is a high percentage. As I say, we have from 2012 3,000 transactions that don't match, and I didn't get a count of the total number of transactions, but that's a significant percentage. As far as treasurers being uncooperative, we don't really find that. They just take forever in some cases to get this done. This is a big job for treasurers. Now, this is some of the biggest committees. These are two of the caucus committees, and they have more than 100, typically, items to reconcile. And that means they have to look through their records, maybe contact somebody else. It's a lot of work. And then they come in little by little by little. And so the problem isn't that treasurers ultimately are uncooperative. They tell us they're cooperating. It's just that it takes so long. And that means this is a staff project that goes on for a year. And we have to continue to monitor it. I think one other thing I'd like to say about reducing the numbers of these problems, One thing I think we have to face, and the board will certainly talk about it tomorrow, is, as I mentioned, there's not much incentive for treasurers to really be careful about doing accurate work. A lot of mistakes we see are clearly careless. Some cases, the treasurer using our software will simply pick the first name that comes in the drop-down box that looks at all like the donor, rather than looking at the check to make sure it truly is a match. There's not a lot of excuse for that. But one remedy that the board can take that the legislature won't have to be involved in is to not overlook any of these transactions that one might understand looking at a paper report and simply require the amendment. And if we require the amendment and it's required in a reasonable period of time, that will be an incentive in itself for the treasurer to be more careful next time, because they don't want to be amending their reports over and over either.
I have some other comments, but I'll save them because I know there are other members. Senator Stephen?
Thank you, Chair Simon. Mr. Goldsmith, you just touched on it real briefly, but I think all of us here would be interested to hear more about the software improvements that you plan to undertake. You said, essentially, if I may paraphrase, that the data you receive, the data is only as good as the information you receive. And we all know from being candidates that oftentimes we're relying on volunteer treasurers who aren't familiar with different political organizations that may contribute to candidates' campaign committees. The software, I think, although I know there are updates, it seems to me like there could be improvements made to make the software more user accessible for volunteer treasurers. You know, you kind of said there's no excuse for a treasurer not reconciling the name on a check when they do the first drop down that comes up. But you know, when you look at the database, for instance, if you receive a check from Minnesotans for Election Reform, it could possibly be filed under Minnesotans MN, Minnesotans MINN, Minnesotans spelled out entirely. So I only bring this up as an example to say that I think that there are a lot of these errors could be fixed if the database was easier to work with. And you know, I think that the Star Tribune report showed that a lot of the discrepancies were pretty easily explainable, and a lot of it had to do with data entry. So long speech here for a short question of what are you going to do to improve the database?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Name standardization has been one of my issues since I became executive director, not only with committee names, but with donor names, finding a way that we can standardize donor names. One of the difficulties, if you search our database now for a particular donor who's a common donor, you will probably have to search three or four names and add them up together to get all the contributions from that donor, because the data comes in the way candidates entered it rather than from a standardized data system. Other states have tried it and been frustrated in their efforts. The question the chair raises, though, has to do with something that is particularly in our control, and that is standardization of names of entities registered with us. And quite some time ago, we standardized all of Minnesota to MN. Somehow, somewhere along the line, and I don't know whether it was under my watch or under the previous executive director's watch, some Minnesota or MINNs have crept in. And so the chair is right. Those names are no longer standard, and you may have to look two or three places to be able to find the correct name. That is something that we plan to work on. There are many, many small issues like that that will make things work better. The whole question of campaign finance software is a bigger topic than we have today, but at some point we have to move to an internet-based software system. That avoids the issue for Macintosh or Apple users. It avoids the fact that we're supporting now several versions of Windows and several versions of Microsoft Access. That's a significant project if you want more than just a fill-in-the-blank form if you want a record-keeping system, and I think that's still what people do. I don't think we probably want to take several steps back and tell everybody to go back to keeping track of things in Excel and then just re-key it all into a form on the Internet. There will be in our legislation, I presume the board will approve it tomorrow when they meet, a request for a change in the Data Practices Act to change one provision that will enable us to do electronic reporting online. And that is the fact that, as you know, in using the software, you enter transactions that don't get disclosed to the board unless they reach the itemization threshold. If you were to do that online and that data were considered government data, that would be accessible to others. So we need to have a provision that makes that data protected so that neither the board nor other people will have access to that data. The website is another issue. The chair mentioned it, and I mentioned it briefly. The legislature was, we were very thankful that the legislature appropriated to us what the governor and the board recommended last year. Our budget went from $689,000 to $1 million. That will fund 1.4 additional staff persons. The 0.4 will be clerical. That person will do data entry and filing and hopefully be able to generate some reports out of the new SWIFT campaign finance system and take away some of the very clerical duties that program staff are now doing. The other person is a management analyst slash legal analyst, which is similar to a 0.6 position that we have now. That position could just as well be called programs analyst slash management analyst. Everybody in the agency wears multiple hats, and the person in this new position will initially, and we hope to hire just after the first of the year, resumes are all in, will be starting to schedule interviews next week and should be able to hire shortly after that. One of the things that person will be involved in is developing the policies and procedures for our reconciliation process and actually helping us fix problems. What better way to learn than getting in and understanding the problems? Beyond that, that person will take some of the legal responsibilities from the executive director and assistant director, writing advisory opinions and being more involved in investigations. And that will allow me particularly to do what I was actually hired to do and haven't been able particularly to do, and that is manage the agency, work on strategic planning, do programs analysis, and find ways to make us better and monitor whether we're actually accomplishing those goals or not. And that's something that's been frustrating for me not to be able to do.
Just one quick follow-up, Mr. Goldsmith. So the additional monies that you're receiving are not going to go specifically for the database.
No, I missed that piece. I'm sorry. In our budget is approximately $130,000 per year for infrastructure improvements. We did part of those improvements with last year's fiscal money. This was the hardware and software components, so we have updated our systems to the current software and hardware equipment that we need. The money that will be available this year and in subsequent years will be used for website development, conversion to electronic records, and major infrastructure improvements such as that. On the website development front, the first step is to determine what sort of platform and content management system, if anyone, should use. These days, everybody virtually uses some kind of a platform and content management system. Our website is just a bunch of pages created individually and strung together, which is why it looks sort of archaic and is sort of difficult to navigate. We've started that process by meeting with people from Minute Services, and because our first option, our first choice, if it works, will be to go with the state's platform. It will be both more economical and we'll have a support network. The next step in that process is that the assistant director and I will be attending a four-hour orientation introduction class about the state's software infrastructure product and content management system to further review whether that works for us. If it does, the cost of getting in from a software standpoint will be relatively minimal. At that point, we will likely contract with Minute Services themselves to do the major parts of the site development. Now, there are a couple of disadvantages there, and that one of the biggest ones, and the reason we're not there now, is that on its current platform with the current content management system, Minute Services does not support interactive data. They don't support browsing and searching like we have on our website. So we have to host that ourselves and support that ourselves. But they are re-engineering and re-architecting their system, and the new version, which they will start agencies implementing on in the coming year, will support that. And so we'll be working with them to see whether we can't be a fit, and that will help maximize the value of the dollars the legislature has given to us. Otherwise, we'll be forced to look at other sources.
Other questions from the committee members? Comments? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. Thank you for your time here with us today. I guess I just have a quick question for you. It seems like this issue has been plaguing you and your agency for quite a while, as far as the perhaps resources or staffing issues to do a proper auditing on this. To simplify my thoughts, and then my question is, Einstein used to say that, or something to the effect of, doing the same thing over and over again expecting different results is the definition of insanity. And if for a period of time, almost 10 years I'm here, and you've experienced some of the same kinds of issues, have you ever undertaken anything where you've discovered common issues or errors and put something together for treasurers to say, before you submit, do these five steps in reconciliation, and kind of keeping with some bookkeeping practices and techniques that are out there to be able to help individuals? The second part of that, what you were saying, that your threshold is at the level of $100 in discrepancy, and that you drop that down to 50 or a zero tolerance. Is that on the entire report, or is that per campaign contribution? And the reason I ask that is, an individual could contribute $100 to any individual candidate campaign. And if we're going to say that at that level, if that's okay, that we don't have to backtrack at that $100 individual contribution, that could be problematic from my perspective. So if I could just get some more clarification on that.
Sure. Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. First of all, on avoiding repeated reconciliation issues, as I did mention early on, I think our training has been a little off point on that. We've trained on how you get something into the system, or how you put it on a report, but I think we've been have not sufficiently trained on how you categorize that thing and make the decision as to where it goes on the report. Not how you write it out, but how you figure out where it goes. We need to do more work there. We do have a sheet of common problems. I don't think it's been distributed widely. It's used treasurers that have problems, and we do reach out to treasurers that have problems, but you're absolutely right, the same treasurers may come back and have the same problem again. So that's an area that we definitely recognize we need to work on. With respect to the threshold, currently we're reconciling the donors' donations made during the calendar year to what the recipient reported from that same donor. And of course, anything now under $200 isn't itemized, so we don't have anything to do with that. And so the threshold was, comparing those aggregates, if they're within $100, we didn't do anything. I think I'm hearing from this committee, and I expect I'll hear from the board, that we need to look at reducing that, and I think we'll be able to do that. I think that answers your question.
Members, I think that there are a couple other testifiers that might have some time limitations. I think if it's okay, we can come back to Mr. Goldsmith, because there are some other testifiers. So he's going to stick around. Mr. Goldsmith, if that's okay with you, why don't we move on to the next testifier, just in the interest of getting through that list, and that we can close with any other questions or comments for Mr. Goldsmith or the board. The next person on the list is Helen Roberts from House Fiscal Analysis, who just wanted to give us a little bit of a fiscal history of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. Ms. Roberts, thank you. And I think members have handouts, too, in their packets that Ms. Roberts
Mr. prepared. Mr. Chair and members, I'm Helen Roberts from the House Fiscal Staff, and you do have a handout on the recent history of funding for the Campaign Finance Board. And I think, actually, much of this has already just been covered by Mr. Goldsmith, so I don't want to take up too much of your time. Just to note that the Campaign Finance Board's operations are funded through a direct appropriation from the general fund. And as Mr. Goldsmith mentioned, in the last legislative session, the governor and the legislature approved the board's request for an increase in their appropriation to $1 million per year. I've also included on page 3 the actual change item page that was part of the governor's budget that provides a little more information on how they were proposing to use the money and the performance measures that they are proposing. So I think that has already been covered. The last two pages, which I didn't plan to actually talk about in depth, but just to provide to you, is some history of the discussion that's gone on in the legislature about different proposals for funding the board, particularly when there were budget shortfalls and people were looking for other ways to fund the board. I think maybe that discussion isn't as relevant now that they've received a funding increase, but I just provided that for your information.
Any questions or comments from members, from Ms. Roberts? Okay. Thank you, Ms. Roberts.
The next testifier on the list is Jeremy Schroeder from Common Cause in Minnesota. Mr. Schroeder, welcome to the Joint Committee, and please identify yourself for the tape.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeremy Schroeder. I am the Executive Director of Common Cause Minnesota, a good government watchdog group. I'm here to talk about the dire state of Minnesota's campaign and lobbying disclosure, the looming threat of even more money coming into Minnesota elections, how improvements to the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board's website would tremendously help Minnesota's transparency, and finally, how the responsibility to ensure the public's trust in the government is free of corruption lies with the Minnesota State Legislature. Currently, Minnesota ranks an F for lobbyist disclosure, as well as a D-minus for legislative accountability by the Center for Public Integrity. Minnesota has relatively weak disclosure laws, which leaves the state vulnerable to corruption. Citizens have no right to information which could expose and help prevent future acts of nepotism, cronyism, and patronage. Without public access to this information, special interests can spend money to influence government without the public knowledge and without fear of public backlash. Furthermore, the United States Supreme Court decision in Citizens United allows an unprecedented wave of big money independent expenditures on every level of elections. If this were not bad enough, the court is currently deciding a case which would remove the limits for candidate campaigns, allowing even more money into elections. With these demanding challenges to protect the integrity of Minnesota's elections and government, the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board's website is woefully inadequate. Citizens need to easily and accurately find out the influence on their government, and the campaign finance website does neither. That being said, there's only so much that the Campaign Finance Board can do with this limited budget. Common Cause Minnesota has been working with the Campaign Finance Board to increase disclosure laws throughout the state, as well as exposing and prosecuting current violations. Limited staff and resources have time and time again delayed investigations, not to mention improvements to their website. Common Cause Minnesota hopes that this attention currently given to the inadequacies of the Campaign Finance Board's website is not just used to correct the problems with the current site, but will instead be used to look to the future and the future needs to improve the site to allow for greater reporting and disclosure throughout the state. Other states use technology to allow citizens access to more frequent reporting and greater levels of disclosure than we currently do here in Minnesota, and Common Cause ask that this opportunity to improve the website also be considered. Finally, we felt it needed to be said that this body controls the budget for the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. Minnesota needs to ensure the faith that the public puts in its elected officials is not unfounded, and that responsibility lies with the state legislature to fully fund the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board now and into the future. Thank you very much for your time on this issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schroeder, I have a question for you. Can you think of an example or two of information that you are not able to find on the website that you wish you were able to find? Just so you can give us a real-life example of something you think ought to be there.
Of course. As I mentioned in my testimony, we're just seeing larger amounts of money on every level, and Common Cause Minnesota is part of a national organization. What other states have been doing is they've increased their disclosure for absolutely every election that happens throughout the state. That's not possible due to kind of lack of resources, and that is not reported on the website at all. Is that a good? Does that answer your question?
Sure. I was just trying to get a flavor of.
Now, to be fair, that's on a very low level that we're talking. Like some of the, we're talking like municipalities and other elections.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schrader, you indicated that you feel a lack of funding and staff has been a cause for delays in investigations by the board. And you seem to feel that, you know, we really should be looking at fully funding the board. Can you give us some examples of investigations that you are aware of that have been delayed because of not properly funding the board?
Certainly. We have one investigation currently. Now, to be full, to give credit where credit is due, the Campaign Finance Board is one of, is the only state that has pursued an investigation on, we have been looking into the American Legislative and Exchange Council, and Minnesota is the only one that's kind of pursued that complaint. Now, that being said, it's been taking a very long time with the limited staff to pursue that. That is something that, while other states have not done, the Campaign Finance Board here, I'm very proud to say, has followed up on that. But due to lack of resources to follow up with the American Legislative Exchange Council and to go through that, it's been taking quite a long time. Does that answer your question, Senator?
Just Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up. Any other examples that you can give?
Not
off any top. Any examples with respect to specific campaigns for office in the state of Minnesota?
Not that we're involved with that I can think of off the top of my head.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Other questions for Mr. Schrader? Thank you for your testimony. The next on the list is Sherry Knuth with the Minnesota League of Women Voters. Ms. Knuth, welcome to the Joint Committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Good afternoon, Senator Sieben, Representative Simon, and members of the committee. My name is Sherry Knuth, and I am the Policy and Outreach Manager for League of Women Voters Minnesota, a 93-year-old organization that encourages active and informed participation in government. Our work is always nonpartisan. While we take positions on public issues, we never support political parties or candidates for office. One of the League of Women Voters' core principles is to promote an open government that is representative, accountable, and responsive. To that end, we believe that methods of financing political campaigns should ensure the public's right to know, combat corruption, and undue influence, enable candidates to compete more equitably for public office, and allow maximum citizen participation in the political process. League of Women Voters recently published a new report on campaign finance in Minnesota and our recommendations for reform. The recommended reforms focus on measures that would provide greater disclosure so that voters know who is trying to influence the outcome of elections and can cast an informed vote. Voters can also hold their elected officials accountable if the laws that they enact tend to reflect the interest of financial contributors rather than the public interest. Today, I will focus on the recommendation in the report that is pertinent to the topic of this hearing. Online publication of campaign contributions and expenditures is key to ensuring transparency in every campaign finance disclosure system. The internet is the most effective way for states to share information on campaign finance. Campaign finance data should be accurate and accessible via the internet. While data on campaign contributions and expenditures in Minnesota is online through the Campaign Finance Board's website, improvements are needed to make it more accessible for all users. Currently, the website is difficult to navigate for data on campaign contributions and spending. The website does not follow conventional practices that would guide general users to readily search the page for information on campaign contributions and expenditures in the state. To ensure that the board's website genuinely contributes to making Minnesota's disclosure system more transparent, the website should be improved to allow for greater accessibility. The state of Washington provides an excellent example of a campaign finance website that allows the public to follow the money. The Washington website includes the following features: a user-friendly website design, information on available content and how to use the website, comprehensive campaign finance databases, advanced search tools that allow results to be filtered for specific content, and maps that compare total amounts raised by county for gubernatorial and legislative races. League of Women Voters recognizes that the Campaign Finance Board has faced limitations in funding that likely have made it difficult to maintain a state-of-the-art website. Thus, the board may need additional funding to provide a website designed to meet the needs and interests of the public. We also understand that legislators need to weigh carefully every dollar in the state's budget. Yet, it is clear that many Minnesotans are uneasy about the role of special interests in campaign contributions and spending in our elections, and that there is public support for transparency and disclosure. While addressing concerns about the accuracies of data on the campaign finance website, League of Women Voters urges you to not lose sight of the underlying purpose of campaign finance disclosure to ensure the public's right to know. All of the laws and regulations in the world will not achieve that purpose unless the website provides reasonable access for citizens. The public needs accurate data and accessibility to that data in a manner that genuinely provides transparency. Thank you for your consideration of this issue, which is important for voters and the health of the democracy in this state.
Thank you, Ms. Knuth. Are there questions or comments? Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Senator Sieben. Ms. Knuth, I agree with the goal of having web-based tools that are easy and meaningful for evaluating information that are contained in the reports. But I find in general the public is not overly engaged in campaign finance issues. They are smart to recognize there's a problem, but the amount of knowledge, even if you have a good website, the amount of knowledge that you need in order to evaluate and then do something about these issues, I think, is kind of several steps further than most citizens are prepared to go. Do you find, as an organization like League of Women Voters or maybe other similarly sophisticated organizations on this issue, that the current website provides you what you need in order to do an analysis, or do you think that even for sophisticated users like you, the current electronic tools are insufficient?
Representative Winkler and members of the committee, I think that for our members, the website is intimidating. For most people that I speak to, who members of the public and the league, I think there's a general level of, I don't know if it's confusion or fear of actually digging in deep, because it's a very complex matter for most people to understand. And I have found that even members of the league, who I consider relatively sophisticated and willing to dig into somewhat wonky issues or technical issues related to good government, that the website is government, that the website is very difficult to manage.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Senator Sieben. Ms. Knuth, just a quick follow-up then. Do you think that in comparison, I think there was a Washington State example, do you think in comparison the above normally interested citizen who has some knowledge would have a meaningful, that's meaningfully better than what we have today? And so is your suggestion that for those people who are truly interested, it would make a big difference to have a different set of tools available?
I represent Winkler and members of the committee. I do believe it would make a big difference to have a different type of website that provides more ready access, and not only for the general citizen who still might not use it regularly, but for the media, which is an important, very important part of ensuring that our government functions well. I think the Star Tribune is actually probably rare in its ability to find the resources and time to dig into the website, and that many media would make more use of it if it was more readily accessible. People who work for watchdog groups in Minnesota, whether, you know, across the span of the political spectrum, could make better access to the website if it was more user-friendly. And you know, by those people accessing, it helps get information out to the public.
Good points. Thank you, Ms. Knuth, for your testimony today. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Lane.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. As you were talking here, you're talking mostly about website and reporting and accessibility, but yet you said that the purpose is the public's right to know accurate, transparent information. So there certainly is a circular thing here, whereas if you have it on the website, you're going to have to make sure that it's accurate and it's going to go round and round. But it seems like the reporting of the data and the access to the data and the timelines and all these different searchability, all these things depend on the data being accurate. And as the Campaign Finance Board spoke, there's a difference between inaccuracies through the treasurers and things and the reconciliation and simple, and whether it's fraud. The implication when we see a report in the paper is that this is fraud going on. And we have to be aware that if there are these loopholes, fraud could easily happen. But would you find that where you, when you said the bottom line is accuracy and transparency, chicken or egg, which comes first, the accuracy of the data or the website?
Representative Lane and members of the committee, I think the two go hand in hand, and to improve website accuracy and internet-based reporting would be helpful with regard to campaign finance reports, and that information could feed more directly into website access. And I think as the website is now, it's if I were a person looking for information about who contributed to a candidate that I was going to vote for, the website would be very helpful, even with the mistakes that the Campaign Finance Board acknowledges are in it, but it could be more helpful to me if it was in a better format that allows me to understand how to access certain information and guides me through. So improving the website with the data as is would be helpful, but certainly the whole package deal would be the ultimate goal, I think.
Thank you, Ms. Knuth.
Thank you.
Mr. Goldsmith, just in by way of closing comments, I was reflecting a bit on what you said. Some of the additional expenditures will be used for, and I think you've heard pretty clearly from the committee that, or the joint committees, that we are interested in seeing a better website. And I understand that, hear that, and then it's not exactly clear all the time about what that means. But there has been references made to other states and what their websites are able to do. And I think members received from Chair Simon and I both this report on best practices for state campaign finance disclosure, which had pretty extensive comments and comparisons of different state databases. So I'm encouraged that you're using some of these additional appropriations to better develop the website. I would hope that when you look to hire the additional staff, that person is capable of also helping support the limited staff that you have, that you manage in the development of that website, because I think that that is a crucial component to increase transparency and a searchable database that's more easily usable by the public. That, Chair Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Goldsmith, as to the website, I've heard from a number of people who have been involved in the campaign finance on both sides of the aisle, actually, that one thing that would help them, and I don't even know if this is a website issue as much as it is just aggregating information, is they think it would be helpful if there is more in the way of aggregate information that's revealed or released periodically by campaign finance board. For example, right now it can be very difficult, certainly time-consuming for someone, be it a citizen or a reporter, to find aggregate information such as, you know, how much money was spent by political committees in a particular cycle or segment or campaign period, or how much money was received by all GOP legislative candidates or all DFL legislative candidates combined, or you know, who are the top 10 or top 20 or top 30 donors in the state, and who are the top 10 or 20 or 30 recipients in the state. Those kinds of interesting lists or categories are things that aren't even necessarily an interactivity issue on the website, but maybe something that's been called to my attention that would be helpful to a lot of folks to think about what categories would be meaningful to everyday people. And to media and to legislators and others. Can you comment on your receptivity to that sort of thing?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. That's just the tip of the iceberg as far as improvements that could be made to the website. Once we launch this project and actually release things that you look at, you won't recognize the website. I can assure you of that. I've looked at Washington's website in depth. I think it has some good things. I don't know that it has aggregate totals. I think there are lots of ways of looking at the data, and as I've said at the beginning of this testimony, one of the board's goals is to put the data into contexts that are meaningful to citizens. So aggregate totals, county references, and so on are going to be important, and I expect that we'll see all of those things. I did want to take this opportunity, number one, to make one correction and to make one additional point. The correction is that the highest unreconciled transaction, my assistant director points out, was not the Democratic Party but the Republican state party, and it was $9 million in 2002. So I stand corrected on that. But the scenario was the same. It was just a reporting error using the wrong donor source. The history of the Campaign Finance Board dating back to the previous executive director was that the board typically, always almost under the previous director, never asked the legislature for more money. That did change when I became director, and 4 years ago I started asking for money for more staff, and last year the legislature gave us that money. By the way, we don't need any more investigative staff beyond what we have and what we'll work in through the new funding. As I mentioned, we have a compliance officer who's sort of doing double duty, but we will divert other staff to that position. Washington is not all that different from Minnesota, Washington State. We have about 750 candidates. They have about 500 candidates. In total, when you include candidates, party units, and committees, we have about 1,500, and they have 1,125. We have 1,400 lobbyists, they have 700, and they have many fewer public officials than we have. On the other hand, they have 19 staff and an annual budget of $2 million. We have 9 staff and an annual budget of $1 million. They do their IT in-house, they do their website. If you look at their annual reports, every year there are significant improvements to their website. They have 4 IT staff, and that doesn't include 3 data entry and scanning staff. So that's one of the differences. To some extent, you have to recognize that you get what you pay for, and our goal has always been to do the best we can with the resources we have, and we'll continue to do that. I do think that with the funding the legislature gave us, we'll make significant and regular progress. But I will tell you that $130,000 is not enough to rebuild a whole website that will be anything like the Washington website. By partnering with Minute Services, we hope that we can maximize the use of those dollars and make progress, but this is going to be a multi-year process.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair. Mr. Goldsmith, I appreciate the efforts of you and your staff, and I think with your report today, I hear some good things about planned improvements with the funding that you have and redirecting of your staff, and I'm encouraged to hear that. It seems a common refrain amongst candidates and everybody else of wanting to be able to have more resources, but we all have to function within what we have provided and do our best, and I know you do that. One of the things, though, you mentioned that was prompted by another question as well and yourself, and that is, I think my question is, do you have, are there any outstanding cases right now or outstanding pending things that have gone on for a while that that you've not had the staff to accomplish what you wanted to? Is there something currently, I think, I'm just asking the question, is there something lacking right now?
Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, you know, we're always behind. That's the nature of small agencies. If you're talking about investigative matters, of course we can't talk about those, but I would say we have adequate resources and we're comfortable with where we are on those matters. I'm not happy with the fact that we haven't completed the reconciliation process from 2012, and that is a resource issue, but we're close to being completed and we'll finish it before the 2013 reports come in, and they will be a lot smaller because it's not an election year. So I think the answer generally would be we're satisfied with the resources we have, but the legislature and the public have to recognize that with those resources, particularly in the web development, that's not something that's going to turn over in 6 months or 12 months. It will take some time.
Okay, thank you.
Other comments? Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Goldsmith, as I think about kind of two functions of having an accurate reporting system available online, one of them, of course, is to provide the paper trail and the information that people are looking at. Another is that when people are filling out their reports, they have to have the expectation that anything that they put on that report that is inaccurate, whether through mistake or dishonesty, is somehow going to be caught. And that kind of fear of penalty, the fear of public embarrassment, or the fear of being caught doing something that you're not supposed to do, I'm sure is one of the reasons why people do their best, to the extent they do, to provide accurate information. So kind of a simple question. The information uncovered by the Star Tribune has raised some questions. The question to you is, should people who are submitting reports to you about campaign finance activity have the expectation that if they have information that is inaccurate or is substantially incorrect in some way, that that will be picked up and there will be a consequence for that?
Mr.
Boltzmann. Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, I think the answer to the first part of your question is yes, they should expect that that will be picked up, to the extent that by reviewing reports and cross-reviewing reports we can do that. The consequence is that they will hear from us and they will have to fix it. However, as I pointed out earlier, making a mistake isn't a violation, so there will be, unless the board directs, there would be no list of people who have made mistakes and fixed them, and there would be no penalty. However, I think that when we become more rigorous on requiring these to be amended and amended correctly, eventually that will reduce the number of reports that come in incorrectly in the first place.
Madam Chair, just one final comment. Successful IT projects can be done on very limited money. They can be done on a lot of money, and failures can be cheap or failures can be expensive. And I'm sure we can all think of current examples and past examples of both. So I just, for my part, I would say that I have every confidence that the Campaign Finance Board can do these changes successfully, and would just encourage you to continue to bring back regular progress reports to the legislature, because I think we're all very interested in making sure that this goes well. And personally, I'm sure most people here are committed to making sure that your work is supported and that we are pursuing disclosure and accuracy as much as we can. And you know, we don't have to send you millions and millions of dollars to do it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Goldsmith, before we conclude, I just want to get a final sense of some timeline items for you. I'm sort of stitching together some things that you said. So my understanding is that you have a meeting tomorrow of the Campaign Finance Board, and at that meeting you will present a plan, basically a suggestion or some proposals for going forward, which will include pieces on the reconciliation, which will include pieces on the website. I think you said the website is a longer-term project. You don't necessarily expect a complete remake of the website in 6 months or a year. Could you just give us a little bit of a sense? I've just sketched it out. I want to make sure I'm understanding a timeline going forward of actual dates or ranges of times in which you expect to accomplish certain milestones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is, of course, still a work in progress. It's been a busy last month as I've had conferences and training, so my work days have been limited. So tomorrow, when I address the board, it will be to tell them about the immediate steps we're going to put in place, which I talked about, how the reconciliation will become more rigorous and data entry will become more rigorous and data quality will go up immediately, prospectively, and then I'll talk to the board and seek direction from them as to what they want to do going back in time. With regard to staffing, we'll be hiring a new management analyst position, hopefully. Well, we'll certainly be hiring it in January, so that will provide additional resources for all of our programs. These positions tend to go where they're needed at any given time. I haven't heard back from Minute Services as to when their next four-hour orientation is to their software platform. That's the next step, is to determine whether we can go with the state's platform. Representative Winkler talked about doing web projects on low budgets, and if this works, that will be by far the best way to do it because they've developed lots of components and tools. Likewise, it will look and feel much more like other state agency websites. The drawback there is that they haven't given us any firm timeline on when they can do interactive data, and it may be that we end up with a dual hosting system. It may be that they divert us for a while. Even while we're developing, they don't allow us to release things. So I can't, at this point, give you a firm timeline on web development. Those are just questions that are up in the air.
Members, any other? Senator Limmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Goldsmith, earlier this afternoon, you talked about an outstanding, I guess, lack of a better understanding, an investigation on a matter from 2002. Was it? Did I hear you correctly?
Mr. Goldsmith?
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, no, not an investigation. This is part of the reconciliation process where we're going back looking at large unreconciled transactions. We're going back all the way to 2000, looking at some of the top ones, and then going to our physical files to determine whether we can determine from the file whether that should still be in the database as a reconciliation item or corrected. So these are not involving the committees that are involved. Committees are only required to keep records for 4 years, and our approach so far has been, unless the board directs otherwise, is that we're going to look at these things based on our files and resolve them to the extent we can, and then in the most recent 4 years, if we need to, we will probably go back to the committees.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, is that four-year look back, is that, would that be considered like a de facto statute of limitations?
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, in a way it is. On the other hand, committees often do have records that go back further than that. So we don't take the position in an investigation, for example, that there's a four-year statute of limitations, but the committee could rightfully come to us and say we have no records because they were retained for the requisite period and then destroyed. But unless there's a very good reason, an unusual reason, we wouldn't typically go back to a committee further than that.
Yeah. Mr. Chair,
Senator Lemon.
I was just kind of piecing a timeline together. Is it possible that someone could get elected having used maybe some unscrupulous methods a accounting practices to spend more money, let's say, and narrowly winning an election and actually get sworn into office and fulfill almost a full term without ever getting caught and having a question so severe that it might raise a question of whether they honestly won an election or not?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Here, Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer.
On the timetable that we're kind of suffering with right now?
I don't think that's possible barring an actual fictitious report. And if somebody files a fictitious report, then they could spend as much money as they wanted and not report it unless somebody else knew about it and filed a complaint. It wouldn't show up on a report and we wouldn't know about it. These reconciliation, let me back up. Before we even start reconciliation, we run all of our routine compliance routines, and they're handled very promptly. Excess spending, sessional contributions, excess contributions, special source limits, all those violations that show up on reports are dealt with, and then we turn to reconciliation, which really is a mismatch of contributions. Theoretically, a person could do anything they wanted if they didn't report it, and we would have no way of knowing about it.
Any other comments? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But, Mr. Goldsmith, if someone does, in fact, file a complaint, then the board would move towards this this reconciliation. Is that not correct?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, I'm not quite sure I understand the question, but I think I can answer it anyway. If somebody does file a complaint on any matter, the board will, by authority directed to me, first of all, I look at it and I determine whether, if what it says is true, would there be a violation of Chapter 10A. If that's true, I would either commence an investigation or take it to the board and explain it to them and let them make the decision. But yes, we're required to investigate all complaints that aren't frivolous.
Senator Newman.
Mr. Chair, I probably articulated my question kind of clumsily, but you had brought up a possibility of a fictitious report being filed, and that's why I asked, well, if someone brings it to your attention with respect to a complaint, you are then obligated to reconcile or investigate. And if I understand correctly, once the complaint is filed, you're obligated to make some kind of a determination within 30 or 60 days, depending on the circumstances. Is that not correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, that's correct. In fact, we regularly get complaints where an opponent claims that their opponent didn't disclose this or that on their report, and often those are substantiated. The board is required to investigate those complaints and is required to make a determination within 60 days unless the board decides that it needs to extend that period, and it may do that by motion at a meeting.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Newman.
In the event that the board does make a recommendation to extend the time period, is that something that is a matter of public record, or is that wholly within the discretion of the board itself?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, first of all, it's within the discretion of the board, and it just depends on the particular investigation. It would become public. By statute, investigations and any board action on investigations are confidential and not available to the public until the board makes findings. At that time, the findings become public, as does the official record of the investigation. The record includes correspondence between parties and the board, or attorneys and the board, formal discovery-type documents, formal interview-type documents. By statute, the actual action of the board and votes of the board remain confidential, so the board's decision to extend the time of investigation would remain confidential.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
So, Mr. Goldsmith, if I was to inquire of you of an investigation, or I should say a complaint that had been filed over a year ago and has not yet been resolved, the board has extended by motion the time period in which it has to resolve the matter, you wouldn't be able to tell me about it anyhow because, in your view, it's a confidential matter. Is that correct?
Mr. Goldsmith.
That's correct. There's actually a statutory penalty if I was to disclose board action on an investigation.
Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Members, any other comments or questions? Senator Kittmeyer.
Well, you know, I hear this and I just think to myself, is there any sort of, you know, how long could this board go on and extend? I mean, because justice in part is about prompt action. So if you have something like this going on, is there a limit to how long or how often they can renew these extensions? Is there any sort of limit at all?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, there's no limit in statute. I presented to the financial committees last year, and I did not bring for this committee a chart that shows that in 2012, 36 complaints were filed, and these are in addition to all of the violations that we find just looking at reports, 36 actual complaints that were substantive and accepted by the board for investigation. That's more complaints than the board staff can investigate in a year, and the board will prioritize those complaints based on a number of factors, but there's no statutory limit as to how long the board can extend that. It's done with notice to both the complainant and the respondent in each case, and typically without objection by either the complainant or respondent. I think that if the legislature should decide that there is an absolute deadline by which matters must be resolved by the board, some matters would be end up being dismissed for lack of the ability to process them in the time available. Now, let me also say that the legislature's addition of a staff person will help in that, although our complaint load is becoming low and hopefully will remain low. That staff person will do mostly other things, but should the need arise, should there be a bubble in complaints, we have a number of staff people that can be moved to that area. So I think that with this new staff member coming on board, that will smooth out the bubbles and eliminate most of that problem. But I hope that answers your question.
Just Senator Kittmeyer.
Thank you. Mr. Goldsmith, you know, I understand all of that. Do you also have the authority to, you know, if something's taking a little bit longer, just to kind of help keep it under that reasonable area of investigations, do you have the ability to refer this out to a third party to give you some assistance?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, we do not have that ability.
Do not have the ability or the authority either?
Well, I don't think we have the authority. Mm-hmm. There's no statutory authority for contracting with a third party to conduct investigations.
Okay, thank you.
Members, any other comments, questions? Representative Johnson.
You meant, Mr. Goldsmith, Mr. Chair, Mr. Goldsmith, you mentioned you had 36 investigations or complaints from 2012 that you investigated?
Mr. Goldsmith.
That's correct.
And
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Goldsmith, how many outstanding investigations you still have at this time? You said it was low.
Sure. At this point, I am going to decline to comment more specifically than that because the complaint process is confidential, and while it is far fewer than 36, we're making progress, I don't want to be any more specific than that. And the 36 was the number of complaints filed during that calendar year and accepted for investigation.
Any other member comments or questions? Well, thanks, members, and thanks, Mr. Goldsmith, too, for your time in addressing these concerns and the challenges that I know that your agency faces. Thanks for your time, your dedication, and your work on this, and we'll look forward to having an ongoing dialogue and exchange on these issues. For House members, please remember your member reimbursement form is right here on the blue paper. Just submit them to Mr. Gelbman, if you would. So we can get those in for you as soon as possible. If there's no other comment or no other questions, the hearing is adjourned.